Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, where you hear about the business of the casino entertainment industry from the people who make it happen. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of Global Gaming Business, and this week we feature a special interview with entertainer Wayne Newton on the current state of entertainment in the casino industry. Since his debut in downtown as a teenager in the late 1950s, Wayne Newton has been inexorably tied to entertainment in Las Vegas. Known as Mr. Las Vegas, Newton has seen all phases of casino entertainment, from superstar entertainers to production shows, magicians, impressionists, and more. He was elected to the American Gaming Association Gaming Hall of Fame in 2000. Newton spoke with me over the phone from his office in Las Vegas in mid-July. Wayne Newton, thanks for joining us on the Global Gaming Business Podcast. It's an honor to have you on the broadcast. We really want to talk about casino entertainment and what your role has been. And when was the first time you played? I know it was at the Sahara, correct?
Actually, it was downtown Las Vegas.
Okay.
The first place I ever played, I was 15 years old. It was the Fremont Hotel downtown.
Okay.
And we were there 5 years, did 6 shows a night, 6 nights a week.
And then you got your big break when you went to the Sahara on the Strip, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. Actually, I went to the Sahara, and then I got an offer to play the Flamingo.
Okay.
And so I was slated to be opening act for a comic, and as the date grew near, I sent my representatives, and I said, you know, I think it's not my headline, and so they booked me in November of 1963 as the headliner at the Flamingo, and of course in those years it wasn't the seasonal, I mean it was the seasonal town, certainly not like today where that really doesn't matter much, but in those years in November you could shoot a cannon off of a top street and never hit anybody until Christmas and New Year's and big holidays. The local people came out and supported me, and thank God that kind of saved my career. I was off and running.
Right, and that was one of my questions. What was the audience like in those days? Was it mostly all visitors, or were there some locals at that point?
Well, in that time of year, luckily, it was all locals. The people that we had built an audience with, being at the Fremont, these people came out in droves, because if we had to depend on the tourists, there weren't many in that time of year. Come, you know, Thanksgiving for a couple of days for a lot of people, and then with the Christmas holiday and New Year's, then it was packed again. But prior to that, it wasn't. It was pretty much a ghost town.
Uh-huh. You know? And then, I guess you had a big following then among the locals.
Yes, thank God. As I've always said, they truly saved my life and my career by showing up, because it was they were taking bets up and down the Strip, I think, and a few of the places that held bets for ball games and those kind of things. Sports books, they were taking bets as to whether or not we'd last. So
right.
The fact that the locals came out was really, really significant.
Yeah, that's great. Tell me how you consider Las Vegas in terms of whether Las Vegas made your career or you brought your career to Las Vegas. How did that work?
I think it probably, if I had to be totally candid with you, Roger, I think it probably is a little bit of both. In the years that I was headlining in Las Vegas, in the beginning, the embryonic stage, I should say, the truth of the matter was that it was a very interesting town. It was a small town. You could know everybody. You could know the people you're working for, on and on and on. Then, as Las Vegas continued to grow, for example, in the 60s and early 70s, you could not do a television show from Las Vegas, because you couldn't find any sponsors. They wouldn't. It was just too much of a, you know, Sin City for them in those years. And as Las Vegas continued to grow, and I just didn't go away, I guess, it kind of became, you know, I became synonymous with it and it with me. But I think that probably it was a little bit of both. It was the fact that I was having some hit records, and I was still doing my 30 weeks a year in Las Vegas. So as Sammy Davis once said to me, when people come to Las Vegas, the two things they want to see are Wayne Newton and Boulder Dam. So I'm not sure that was much of a compliment,
right.
But it was true.
Why didn't you, leave Las Vegas? You had some pretty big hit records there in the early 60s, and you could have lived anywhere in the world and really advanced your career. Why did you stay in Las Vegas?
I moved from Virginia when I was 9 years old, my family, to Phoenix, Arizona, because I had bronchial asthma. And so when I came up to Las Vegas, the weather here was reminiscent of that in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I had no attacks, and I wasn't sick all the time. And so it was kind of an evolution thing, I think, where we started out doing, maybe 12 weeks a year, and then it turned into, as time progressed on, it turned into 40 weeks a year. So I realized that it was easier for me, even though I did some touring, it was easier for me to stay here because we were appearing in rooms that were made to be show rooms, and the production value and the sound value and those things that were really important then and now were prevalent, and we didn't have to work at it,
Right. So you didn't have to go to a new facility every night and balance the sound.
Exactly. A new venue and deal with the changes of sound and deal with the changes of light and all those kind of things.
Right. So, and of course, you were happy and healthy then, I guess, in Las Vegas.
Yes. Yes, thank God. Uh-huh. Yeah.
What was the entertainment business in Vegas like in those days? I'm talking about the late 50s, early 60s. Was it run by any specific group or any specific person that you had to get the imprimatur from?
No, not really. Frank was of course a mainstay in Las Vegas.
Sure.
Here's Frank Sinatra. And then of course Dean, Sammy, Joey Bishop. Then of course Elvis came in kind of the late 60s at the Frontier, and then in the mid 70s over at the Hilton, Bobby Darin, Liberace. There were a whole group of people that actually headlined the strip you could depend on any given night to see an honest-to-God headliner.
Yes. So the lounges were very important in those days as well, too, because the headliners would go to the lounges.
They were the training ground, I think, for, the young performers coming on, people like myself. Mm-hmm. Of course, Rickles came out of the lounge.
Sure.
Shaky Green came out of the lounges, on and on. I mean, it was pretty amazing the kind of training that one could get. It truly doesn't pretty much exist anymore.
Right, and some of the people that really never came out of the lounges, Sam Buteras, Kelly Smith, Louis Primas, those guys were just incredibly talented, and they were a real secret of Las Vegas at that point.
No question about it. In fact, the first main room show that I saw as a lounge act was Louis and Kelly at Harrah's in Tahoe. They had moved them out of the lounge at the main room.
Uh-huh.
And they continued to be headliners in the main room up until they split up, their marriage split up.
Right.
And then they both went back to the lounges before we lost Billy. And I think Keely still does play lounges once in a while here.
Yes, in fact, I saw her with Sam Butera in Atlantic City just a few years ago. And
yes, and she's just as great as ever, isn't she?
They brought the house down. It was amazing.
I said, yeah, just fabulous.
Yes. Now the headliners, came and went in Las Vegas. They would come and play a few weeks, but you had, I like to compare it to the first kind of Celine Dion type of show where you had the 30 weeks in one joint.
As a matter of fact, Roger, I played, I think, and we did two shows a night, seven nights a week in those years. I say we, the talent, did that.
Right.
Only me. Everybody who played here did that. And I think my longest run, and I was working for Howard Hughes Hotels at the time, between the Frontier Desert and Sands, I did 36 weeks without a day off.
Yeah. That's amazing. Three shows a night.
Two shows a night.
Yeah.
And sometimes three on the weekends.
Uh-huh. Do you feel that really honed your entertainment ability to be able to do that, to be able to go out there twice or three times a night?
There's no question about it. I think it even doing one show a night now, which is what the town does primarily, most acts find that very difficult to do because they've never really trained for that.
Right.
It's kind of the Olympics of entertainment, if you will.
Right.
It takes really, honest to God, training and perseverance, dedication, and discipline mm-hmm. to that kind of schedule.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the Howard Hughes era there. You mentioned that a second ago. That was a pretty much of an innovative time in Las Vegas. A lot of changes in what was going on in the town. How did that affect the entertainment world at that point? Because that was he was buying a hotel, seemed like, every week.
It pretty much so. Now, in the years of Howard Hughes, the Gaming Commission had a limit that any one person could own. Yeah. And the limit of hotels for Howard is, I think, 5. And so between Reno and Vegas, he owned the 5 hotels. Now, once, you know, time has moved on and publicly held companies have come into play, now we're looking at monopolies of maybe 3 big organizations that pretty much own the whole town.
Uh-huh.
There's only maybe 1 or 2 people that I can think of in terms of hotels that are still privately owned.
Sure, sure.
Now, when Howard Hughes came here, that was kind of the beginning of what has come to be now, you know.
Sure.
And
mm-hmm.
I think that the gaming community felt that it was a publicly held company that they could regulate it easier and be more effective in terms of the regulations. You know?
Right. Right. Did that kind of open up Las Vegas to the television shows and things that you had mentioned previously because it was a publicly held company?
The two biggest changes for Las Vegas in the years that I've been here would have been, firstly, Kirk Kerkorian,
mm-hmm.
When he bought the Flamingo and then built the International, which is ultimately turned into the Open. But
right.
Now it's the International again.
Mm-hmm.
He built that and then moved on to the MGM. Between he and Howard Hughes, I think that those two guys had the major, most important, let me add one more person, Steve
okay.
Wynn.
Right,
I think between those three people, they had the most positive effect on what the town has become.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And in terms of...
Now, of course, with that goes the entertainment, you know, where that goes, so does the entertainment go.
Yeah, absolutely, you know? Yeah. And so when you were playing for Howard Hughes, did you ever meet him, or was it just...
Well, the truth of the matter is I met him twice,
uh-huh.
and both times were very brief meetings,
uh-huh.
and then I had one of his secretaries visit me one night.
Uh-huh.
He had 5 Mormon secretaries,
uh-huh.
and the guy started talking to me like he was a robot, and come to find out, because I called Walter Kane, who was in charge of Mr. Hughes' entertainment program and kind of my adopted grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I just had a guy visit me to give me a message from Mr. Hughes. And he said, did he sound like a robot? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that's what Mr. Hughes does. He rehearses those guys until they get the verbiage down verbatim.
Wow.
And then he sends them out to deliver the message.
Uh-huh.
So I actually met him twice, even though I heard from him quite often,
uh-huh.
you know, in terms of that kind of thing.
Right, right. And then, of course, Kirk Kerkorian is still a legend to this day.
Kirk Kerkorian, I think, in terms of being a legend, is also one of the nicest human beings I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a very dear friend of mine. Literally, from the first time I headlined Las Vegas, he then bought the Flamingo while I was still there.
Uh-huh.
And he and I have been very close friends since.
Mm-hmm. And of course. And then your most recent long-term engagement, I guess, was at the Stardust?
Yes. Actually, I left the Stardust about a year before it was imploded.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I saw it coming. I, having been here as long as I have, I've learned to recognize the,
yes,
the signs along the way. And I saw it coming. And so I went to Mr. Boyd, who owns the Stardust group. And I said, look, you know, I would like to move on before the status is imploded.
Right.
I just don't want to be here when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very understanding and let me out of my last, I think I had 3 years left out of the 10.
Okay.
And I then went to the Hilton for about 6 months,
uh-huh.
and over to Harris for 2 years.
Right.
And now I'm moving back to the MGM.
Yeah, it's coming full circle here, it looks like.
Yes, I think so.
tell me what you think. I mean, you've seen a lot of implosions in Las Vegas. Does it tug at your heartstrings a little bit when you see something like the Stardust go down where you spent so many years?
Well, I tell you, not only does it pull up my heartstrings, but also when they imploded the Aladdin, which I owned for
That's
4
right.
years with a partner, it certainly kind of is a double-edged sword.
Yes.
I mean, you realize that those are times we're never going to see again, and some of those great, great hotels. And in fact, I joke about it. I say the one that bothers me the most being imploded was the Sands, because I was on stage at the time. But the truth of the matter is that I also understand the need to compete, and these hotels have become really destination resorts unto themselves. When you consider that the MGM, maybe 10 years ago or 12 years ago, was accepted as the third largest city in the state.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It gives you some idea of what these hotels have become.
Yeah.
So I am thrilled to see where they're going and what they've become, although, you know, one kind of misses the old times too.
Right, right. Okay. I'd like to talk about some of the recent trends in entertainment in Las Vegas. Certainly the Cirque du Soleil shows. You know, they're fascinating, but, you know, I found them to be a little impersonal. What's your impression of them?
Well, you know, I don't mean they being the Cirque shows, but I think all production shows, in some ways, kind of fall into that category. It is, they are impersonal, and once people see them as much as they enjoy them, I'm not sure that it's the kind of thing that you'd want to rush to the fans and take them back to see.
Right.
You know,
right. Mm-hmm.
I think that the entertainment business has been really kind of cyclic here in Vegas, starting with the headliners, you know, up through the 70s and mid 70s. And then when Siegfried and Roy, you know, broke out of the production show and moved to their own headlining spot, then of course we had about 7 or 8 hotels that had magic, you know, illusion shows. And then when Danny Gans broke out of the hotel into his own showroom, then we were kind of inundated with impressionists.
Right.
And following that cycle, we've kind of moved into the search shows, and now we're moving back to the headliners.
Right, right.
So it is truly coming full circle.
Yes, no question. And what's your impression of the real superstar shows, the Celine Dion's, and now we have Bette Midler and Cher at Caesars, and you know, a few similar type of shows. Is that the type of show that you think is going to survive?
I think it will survive. I think that they're doing the best job that I think they could do in terms of mixing headline talent with production show features. Mm-hmm. Also, I think that the days of the headliner standing out there with a big band behind them and doing a 2-hour show could be, you know, pretty much very soon a thing of the past.
Uh-huh.
So I think that it is moving back to the headliners. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that we have the amount of headliners necessary to fill these showrooms that we once had, simply because the training ground has closed down.
Sure. So, yeah, you don't have the lounges playing as much a role as you did in the past.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I see.
So there's no place for the performers to learn their trade.
Right.
You know, if they have not survived the industry to become the accepted name that people recognize when they walk down the street, then it becomes more difficult, and they can only do it now pretty much through television or recordings.
Right.
But
right.
Even those are a lot more fleeting than in the years that you had Jackie Gleason and Bobby Darin show and Ed Sullivan show and those kind of shows that catered to, you know, performing talent.
Sure. And there was a community of performers in Las Vegas in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s where people would get together after their shows and you would really know the other people in town performing. And has that kind of disappeared as well?
That's pretty much totally gone.
Yeah.
And I think probably because of the production thing that we're talking about, when we as performers did those third shows that were really performer shows that you invite all the acts up and down the strip to come and see and participate in, We were doing it with a big band and one singer or a backup group or that kind of thing. It didn't involve a 100 or 200 people in terms of the cast of the show. Mm-hmm. And so I really do believe that will come back. And in fact, we're going to plan doing one probably around December or November when I'm at the MGM this year for the performers. Mm-hmm. But, we're down to, we being the town, we're down to one show a night, and usually it's at 8 or 8:30, and the other shows kind of vary in times between 6 and 9 or 10, depending on the number of shows they have in that particular room at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're going back to MGM, you're going back in August, correct? That's your first...
Actually, we're going back in July. We'll be there July 31st through August 6th.
Okay.
And then October 16th through the 22nd, and November 13th through the 19th. And then we'll be doing probably 12, 14 weeks there next year.
Your involvement in Las Vegas is legendary in terms of how your commitment to the community, the charities that you have sponsored, the events you have put up there, to build the community, to build the involvement with the community. Why have you spent so much time doing that?
I think, Roger, that this town is maybe one of the most unique towns in the world, and I believe it is the most unique town. And this is not speaking in a derisive way against Atlantic City or any place else now that has gaming, which are a great many of the states.
Sure.
But this is the only town that I know of that was built to be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was never converted from anything. We started out with, the adult entertainment in mind, and that's what they've stayed to. The people who live here are some of the most interesting and wonderful people in the world.
Uh-huh.
They're true blue. When they like you, they like you, and when they don't, leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no gray. From that standpoint, it's so the antithesis of what most people think the town would be like. As big as it has grown, interestingly enough, it's still pretty much the same power base.
Uh-huh.
It's the same people who own the casinos and public hotel companies. You can know the governor, you can know the mayor, you can know the people in the city council.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who come here and live here are kind of the pioneers, I call them, of the same group that might have crossed the desert in a covered wagon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they just are real, honest to God people. Of course, it being such a big city now, we run into a few other problems that this kind of population explosion has in terms of crime and those kind of things. But nevertheless, it still is, in my opinion, the best city in the world.
Right. Now, you have a legendary ranch in Las Vegas, and it used to be way on the outskirts of Las Vegas. And of course, now it's almost in the middle of town.
Right in the heart of the city.
It is, we're just seeing it as we drive by. It's just a beautiful piece of land, and I know you've got some wonderful horses in there, and some other animals, and certainly an absolutely wonderful spread.
Thank you very much.
We're
awfully proud of it. We have 52 acres here, and I used to invite people out here, and they said, no, that's too far to drive. I'll get you left in or somewhere in town. Now, of course, we're in the heart of the city.
Right.
And we do have about 75 head of Arabian horses and all kinds of other animals. Penguins, swans, ducks, kangaroos, monkeys, parrots, you name it, it's here.
Well, it must be a great escape from the craziness of the entertainment world in Las Vegas.
Well, it's wonderful to do your job at night and come home.
Right.
I think that's the key for me. I never did really truly live in the hotels that I worked, and I think that probably deals as much to the longevity that we've enjoyed here as anything else. It was the ability to leave it and come home and live a real life and then go back to the fantasy world.
Thanks for joining us on the Global Gaming Business Podcast. If you want to learn more about this or any subject, visit our websites at ggbmagazine.com or casinoconnection.com. To stay in touch with the industry, subscribe to Global Gaming Business Weekly, the industry's only comprehensive electronic news magazine delivered to your desk every Monday morning. Download subscription forms at the Global Gaming Business website. For now, thanks for listening to the Global Gaming Business Podcast.